wonderful. Well, on behalf of my colleagues today, Drs. Glick, Eisenman, Diangona, and Joy Blevins, I'd like to share with you today our findings on planning for prescription drug continuity during a disaster. This research was derived from patients, physicians, pharmacists, and insurers, and their perspectives about the in their process about the drug acquisition process. Is that better? Okay. All right. Our research team has no financial relationships to disclose at this point in time. A little bit better? I can do that.
It's best to leave it here. It's too troublesome to pick it up. Just speak louder.
Okay. Over the last decade, 6 in 10 Americans have experienced at least one chronic medical condition. In 2000, the majority of Americans with a chronic illness were using one prescription medication per year, and while 14% were using two or more medications. You should have the next slide, I suppose. Chronic illness accounts for 50% of all healthcare expenditures in the U.S., and 3 out of every 4 healthcare dollars are attributed to prescription medications. And as the U.S. baby boomer generation continues to age, we can expect increases in chronic illness and medication usage. The image I'm showing you now is an example of the U.S. drug procurement system. It's a complex, interdependent process, and it relies on several stakeholders. We have physicians who need to write prescriptions, pharmacists who need to stock and dispense medications. We have health insurers and pharmacy benefits managers who oversee our insurance benefits. And then we have patients who need to understand and navigate this entire process. And understanding this process is particularly relevant for physicians, patients, and pharmacists because they need to understand how pharmacy benefits work. And this involves understanding refill timeframes. Usually refills are allowed after 75% of use. Understanding which drugs are currently covered under the formulary and what co-payments are associated with different increments of drug medication, so maybe 30, 60, or 90-day units. Effective system use also means coordinating benefits with third-party benefits managers and understanding how to ask them when there are policy changes or how to negotiate larger dispensing units. And so the burden of work for this system is really on the patient, the physician, and the pharmacist to understand this process. Now, this is how the process works under routine circumstances. In a disaster, many of these interdependencies, these arrows, are expected to fail. And this failure may be due to our just-in-time delivery service. So our pharmacies are usually restocking medications every few days. They have a limited drug inventory. Our patients are refilling at the last possible moment. We may also have patients surge in a disaster, so our pharmacists and physicians may not be ready for those higher volumes. And finally, this entire system depends on technology. We have electronic communications to convey insurance benefits, and we rely on ground transportation to deliver those just-in-time supplies. Whoa. So as an example of system reactivity, the system I just showed you is currently reactive to disaster. It's not taking care of these possible failures in advance. And Hurricane Katrina was a good example of that reactivity. After Hurricane Katrina, there was a huge volume of need for replacement medications. And these medications and this replacement volume, while not unusual after disaster, the magnitude of the need overwhelmed our system and made it more vulnerable. And so disaster responders have recently responded and addressed some of this vulnerability by taking proactive steps. The first of these steps was the Emergency RX History Program. That was established after Hurricane Katrina, and it was organized by the nation's leading pharmacies. And this is a prescription record sharing system. It helps our displaced persons and our providers connect with patient medication histories, but that's primarily through the leading pharmacies. Next, the Emergency Prescription Assistance Program was recently activated after Hurricanes Ike and Gustav, and that is designed by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And the purpose of this second proactive system is to provide uninsured disaster victims with one replacement medication refill for any of their medications and to replace any medical equipment that was lost during evacuation or left behind. And while these two systems are certainly good steps in the right direction, they're proactive steps, they are still subject to those vulnerabilities of electronic communication failure and ground transportation failure that I noted earlier. So we need to think about other options, and those other proactive options may be building household prescription drug stockpiles. But there are problems here too. Many Americans do not have sufficient prescription medications on stock at home. In fact, running out of medications can have serious negative consequences, not only in a disaster, but in routine situations as well. So health and safety agencies have recommended some guidelines for people to build household medication stocks, but these guidelines are inconsistent, ranging anywhere from 3 to 30-day increments. And building extra medication supplies may be problematic for the elderly, the poor, the disabled. These individuals have more negative health outcomes, suffer more chronic illness, they're more vulnerable to disaster, negative outcomes, and they may rely on public health safety systems or lack health insurance, which makes building these medication reserves very difficult for these populations most in need. So the purpose of our study was to examine disaster-related prescription drug availability and accessibility in Los Angeles County for individuals who had a chronic medical illness, and our goal was to recommend options for strengthening their disaster management plans. The research we conducted was a collaboration between the UCLA School of Public Health and the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Data was collected involving a mixed methods design, so we collected quantitative information from policy reviews of insurance policies, and then we did qualitative analysis through key informant interviews and focus group interviews. We used semi-structured interview guides that were derived from social and behavioral science literature on chronic illness, prescription drugs, and disaster planning, and our interviews were transcribed verbatim. So let me begin our findings by sharing with you our quantitative analysis, the overview of our insurance pharmacy benefits. We looked at 9 insurance policies that represented 80% of insured people in Los Angeles County. And in reviewing these policies, we found that all of the policies provided a standard 30-day dispensing unit that was available at the retail level for a single copayment. 8 of the 9 policies also provided larger optional dispensing units of anywhere from 60 to 100 days, generally available through mail order, and very few of them available at the retail level, all for a higher copayment. We also found that the policies universally allowed refills after 60 to 75% of use. So if you had a 30-day prescription, you could refill once you had 7 days of medication remaining. Finally, we also reviewed the insurance policies for their ability to provide for patients to build medication reserves. And we found that 2 of the policies had written vacation or replacement options. However, after talking with our insurers who oversaw these policies, 7 of the 9 insurers verbally acknowledged having a vacation or replacement option. And this is another example of the burden of work on the patient, physician, and provider to understand and navigate this process, that there may be a written policy, and there may be a practice, but it's not explicitly stated. Next, in our qualitative analysis, we found 3 common themes that emerged from our interviews with our key informants and our focus group members. And the first theme we're going to look at regards routine prescription medication practices. Among the 158 caregivers and patients that we interviewed, most did not fully understand the intricacies of the drug procurement process, but they did navigate it relatively well. In fact, those who were most successful at navigating the system had physicians who were knowledgeable about the insurance process. They had they received reminders for refills from their pharmacies and from their insurers, and they had good communication and good contact with their local independent pharmacists. Patients who had the greatest difficulty with the system were less acculturated, had fewer resources, and lacked health insurance, and so they were more vulnerable to running out of medications or not obtaining them at all. In respect to routine prescription medication practices at the physician, pharmacist, and insurer level, that dialogue centered around the 30-day drug dispensing unit. Now, our physicians felt that the 30-day drug dispensing unit was harmful to stable patients, particularly those patients who were chronically ill, because the 30-day window allowed them to run out of medications more easily and more quickly. So they advocated higher dispensing units of 60 to 100 days. Our physicians felt that the 30-day drug dispensing unit was not medically derived, but instead set by insurers and pharmacists to minimize risk and to contain costs, as well as to increase profit margins. Next, our pharmacists, similar to our physicians, also felt that the 30-day drug dispensing unit was an impediment to their clients building their medication reserves. In fact, at the retail level, the 30-day unit was quite profitable for retail pharmacists. They could keep a lower inventory of stock, and patients would come in more frequently for other items. However, our pharmacy executives were willing to increase their retail level to 60 to 100-day units so that their patients did not run out of their medications, that they could keep some additional reserves. Finally, like physicians and pharmacists, our insurers also prefer that their members not run low on their medication, and they advocated that patients refill on time and that they use mail order services. Our insurers also believed that the 30-day drug dispensing unit was derived from patient month-to-month premiums and the insurer's desire to reduce any wasted medications. If you were prescribed a medication and you had taken 30 days worth and then your prescription changed, then you would have 60 days lost of medication that would be wasted. And that was the insurance perspective. The second theme that evolved from our interview analysis was around stakeholders' attitudes towards medication reserves, patients building their own medication reserves. And among our patients and caregivers, we found that this group was motivated to have an extra month's supply for routine and disaster purposes. However, many of our patients had not considered the impact of a disaster on their medication needs, so they had not added medications proactively to their household disaster kits if they had one. In fact, some of our patients felt that they could do without their medication for several days, if need be in a disaster. Others had transferred their prescriptions to larger national retail pharmacies for service continuity in case they were displaced. And then finally, only a few had made preemptive lists of their household medication needs. When patients did cite barriers for building these medication reserves, there were three common barriers they noted. First, they identified restrictive insurance policies. They also identified poor patient-physician communication. Maybe they had asked for prescriptions, but the follow-through never happened with their provider. And then, if their household had multiple medications, it was sometimes difficult to balance these multiple schedules to make sure that you refilled on time or had enough reserves. Next, our physicians, pharmacists, and insurers also shared similar attitudes towards patients building their medication reserves. They were generally supportive, but they differed in the best policy on how to build these extra reserves. For example, our physicians were willing to write additional prescriptions for larger amounts. However, sometimes getting insurers to approve those amounts or getting insurers to authorize refill authorize the vacation policies, that was very time intensive and required quite a bit of paperwork, and physicians just didn't have the resources to fulfill that request. So physicians instead came up with some other patient preparedness recommendations, such as printing the patient's electronic medical record that the patient could then add to their own household disaster kit and take it with them if they were displaced. Physicians also encouraged creating patient education materials and creating guidelines and protocols for physicians to encourage patient-physician discussion around chronic illness and disaster planning. Like physicians, our pharmacists were also supportive of patients building their extra medication reserves, and as noted earlier, they were willing to dispense higher amounts at the retail level. However, pharmacists thought that insurers would not be willing to pay for higher dispensing units at the retail level, and pharmacists also believe that patients may not be able to pay for that larger lump sum, that three-month lump sum at one point in time versus their usual month-to-month co-payments on their medications. Pharmacists were also concerned that if patients built their own medication stocks, they would not be able to rotate those stocks effectively to avoid expiration, and that pharmacists were unsure as to whether they had time or if it was even their role to counsel patients on disaster medication planning. Finally, our insurers were also supportive. However, insurers were reluctant to support a specific disaster supply policy. And instead, insurers encouraged, again, that members refill on time or that they use their mail order options. However, only 10% of insurance members ever use mail order. Many of them distrust that service, or it takes some preemptive planning and they fail to plan on time, so they refill at the last moment. Our last theme in our analysis addressed organizational preparedness plans. And not surprisingly, we found that many physicians' offices were not prepared for disaster. In fact, many of our physicians had not had prior disaster education, they'd not had service interruption, and they had not been asked to participate in community drills on preparedness. Pharmacists, on the other hand, were a little bit better prepared for disaster. Our pharmacists had learned from prior experience in being able to organize their disaster preparedness plans, especially at the larger retail level. Larger chains were able to pool their resources from affected areas, while our smaller independent chains were less likely to do so. Those smaller chains would have had to establish relationships in advance with another independent pharmacy someplace else around the county to pool their resources, and many had not done that. Our pharmacists also had concerns about reimbursement and personal liability regarding disasters and replacing emergency medications. Now, while our pharmacists realized that they had a professional and ethical obligation to replace missing medications in an emergency, they wanted an administrative policy similar to the Robert T. Stafford Act, which provides for emergency medical care in disaster. Pharmacists wanted a policy that allowed for medication replacement, gave stipulated specific parameters that addressed personal liability, and that guaranteed reimbursement. Insurers, as our final group, they were very prepared for disaster. They had great internal disaster preparedness plans. They had backup databases. One executive could approve mass refill overrides. They had policies that a patient or a pharmacist could call in and ask for medication history. However, our insurers did not have connections with other groups within that interdependent system of the prescription process. For example, our insurers, if you called me and I approved your insurance for a refill override, I wouldn't know as the insurer whether or not you had a pharmacy to even go to, or if there was a physician available who could change that prescription medication for you. So our insurers lacked these interdependencies. In fact, our insurers assumed that the pharmacist would assume the leading role in a disaster, and insurers would simply take a back seat to provide retroactive reimbursement in good faith once those medications had been dispensed. From these findings, our research team offers three recommendations to strengthen prescription drug continuity during disaster. First, we recommend refining existing policies and developing new ones to build and maintain prescription resources. The current 30-day dispensing unit that we've been talking about is an obstacle to this goal. All of our stakeholders agree that for stable patients, larger dispensing units are appropriate, and they agree that patients should have about 14 to 30 days of prescription stocks on hand. But our stakeholders disagreed on how best to come across with this option of building extra reserves, who was responsible, who should set the policy, who should do the education. So we've offered some strategies here. We recommend redefining insurers' vacation policies to permit a disaster supply of 30 days. We encourage building better trust and use of mail order services and approving higher retail dispensing units for 60 to 100 days. We also encourage early refill reminders via mail, phone, or internet for those beneficiaries to remind them to refill on time. Second, we recommend training of professionals on how to speak with each other and their patients about building medication reserves. Training versus the policy noted earlier is a more timely implementation tool that can be offered to professionals through web-based or print media or through industry guidelines. And so trained professionals can also better inform and educate their patients about how to build reserves and talk to their patients when these procurement strategies change and how the patients can then adopt these new strategies. Our final recommendation is to encourage greater two-way communication, partnership, and participation in disaster drill exercises between local stakeholders and the government. An important outcome of our findings was the realization that collective action is needed by all industry stakeholders. All of our stakeholders need to increase their mutual aid plans with the other stakeholders within that interdependent system, and stakeholders need to include themselves and be asked to be participants more in community-based disaster drill exercises. We currently don't allow enough options for them to participate. And we can also encourage our stakeholders to participate in their profession-based disaster response teams noted here. By participating in these teams, independent stakeholders can network with their broader organizational and regional agencies to build disaster protocols and plans that are, again, reflective of this collective action. So in closing, our research indicates that more individual and collective work is needed, but by not only patients, physicians, pharmacists, and insurers, but by communities as well to strengthen our prescription drug delivery system during a disaster. Our recommendations suggest that policy shifts, professional education, and collective partnerships are needed to help meet these goals. And I'm hoping that you can take some of this information about these strengths and weaknesses in the system back to your communities and start addressing these missing options to strengthen our system. Thank you for the time today. We'll take questions at the end of all of our presentations. Thank you.
That was right on time. Our next presenter